Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries. Matt Everett's The First Time.
With Josh Wame.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest is a singer, songwriter and a producer and one of the coolest people in rock. From Queens of the Stone Age, it's Josh Homme. Josh's musical life predates the Queen's formation in 1996 and extends far beyond their considerable influence. As a punk-obsessed teenager growing up in the Palm Desert in California, Josh played at generator parties, parties in the remote desert powered by a generator, eventually forming the critically acclaimed stoner rock outfit, Caius. As he explains here, Caius outgrew their strict punk ethics and Josh embarked on a career that's included the ever-evolving Queens of the Stone Age, who've included Dave Grohl as one of their members, the supergroup Them Crooked Vultures, who feature Homme, Grohl and Led Zeppelin bass player John Paul Jones, and as a producer, he's collaborated with Arctic Monkeys. He's also earned himself a reputation as being one of the most grounded, philosophical, upstanding and, as I said, coolest people you could possibly want to meet. And I started by asking Josh, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
We used to take these long trips in the summertime, driving. And one of the first records I remember was a Jackson Browne record called Running on Empty. What I didn't realize till much later, like the cover is just a road going straight into nowhere, and the entire record is written and recorded on the road in hotel rooms and one in the back of a bus and live, and they're all songs about the road. So in hindsight, I look back and wonder if there was some sort of just
subliminal
subliminal hammering, because it wasn't that, you know, when you're on a 8 hour plus drive and you're six and the cassette tape just flips out, you know, I remember cassettes just, they'd hit the end and they'd just go boop. They wouldn't, I mean, you'd have to stop it, you know, it just would play over and over.
Drummer, first of all, weren't you?
Well, no, I mean, calling me a drummer is really a stretch. I love to play drums, but am I a drummer? Probably not. I mean,
who were your drumming heroes when you were a kid then?
It wasn't like that. I was nine, you know, and so the notion of having heroic musicians was... it wasn't really that way yet, you know? It was just like, I knew I wanted to tap on stuff. And I played, you know, I'd take anything that was stick-like, from chopsticks to branches, and beat on stuff. There was just something that I just always heard stuff in my head.
So then the first kind of awareness of music would probably be, for most people, their kind of first single they bought. What would be that for you? That you owned. It maybe wasn't your parents that
I was able to get.
Grasped in your sweaty palms.
Yeah, the first thing I ever got was a compilation record called Eastern Front. When you bought vinyls, as you know, they're so physical. They're so, the artwork is so compelling. And I was so young that it was based all on artwork. And there was an illustration of a guy with a mohawk, and it was live in San Francisco, and it was bands from England, which, you know, it just seemed, it wasn't all bands from England, but it was some bands from England, like Cron Gen, and there was a lot of American bands like Channel 3 and Battalion of Saints, and so because it was a compilation, it was a real buffet of a chance to listen to music, and I just bought it purely on the cover, and it kind of assaulted my ears because it was live and it was really brash punk rock music.
Punk rock changed your life?
Pretty much, yeah.
About Black Flag being a band that you've often kind of mentioned as being really important to you. When was the first time you heard them?
Shortly thereafter.
Right.
Within a month. Well, they had such an influence on me and such an influence on my hometown because they actually played my hometown and nobody ever played my hometown.
Why not? Just too far out?
There was nowhere to play, no reason to go, and, you know, no money to be made, no gasoline to get in car, you know, and that notion of SST, which was Black Flag's, which was Greg Ginn's label, and that you really could do it yourself. You didn't need to be on the radio. You did not need to, you know, pursue the accolades of a pop star and riches and fame, that it was this thing that you did. You know, I was so young, I took it as like, this is what you do when you want to pick a religion that's not the other ones. You know what I mean? Because they had that work ethic because you had to do it all yourself.
Yeah, of course.
And so it needed to be that important to you because they weren't making any money, to my knowledge. So it had to be for the respect of it all, for the religion of it all, for the, you know. And so I think that really impacted the whole town at the time because it was like that SST sensibility permeated our music scene. Because it was also like Black Flag to me was like this jazz band, whatever punk rock was supposed to be. If you weren't supposed to have long hair, here they were, they all had long hair. You know, Henry Rollins wore shorts. They kept changing singers, but it didn't matter in that the music was always consistent. And so it meant you could have this kind of revolving cast of people and they could all be important and unimportant at the same time, where it's like they could all be part of an amazing phase, but that you could regenerate and continue. You know, you could regrow a limb that was worth having and wiggling, you know.
What's the Black Flag track that we should play at this juncture?
Honestly, Thirsty and Miserable.
Was that the first gig that you went to? Was Black Flag the first concert that you went to?
No, I was too young to go, and I was also grounded. That was the kind of... That was my age frame. You know, it was like 12.
Wow, that's young.
Yeah. It was the first time I remember thinking, I should sneak out of the house and run. You know, and it was miles away. And I remember thinking, I should run.
So what was the first gig then?
The first gig I ever saw was... I saw Carl Perkins at a place called The Festival, which is very generically named. And
it was a festival.
It's true. It was a single stage festival at a baseball field in Sandpoint, Idaho.
What do you remember from the gig?
Hearing Blue Suede Shoes and connecting the dots between him and Chuck Berry, which is someone that I'd also heard recently. I was about 8 or 9. And the kind of personable, sort of affable charisma that he had. He had this kind of swag that was really cool, and it was like very friendly and very like, you know what I'm talking about. Where if you didn't, you're like, yes, I do, just to sort of agree with you. You
know? Well, it's a one for the money, two for the show, three to get it ready, now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes. Or you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Do anything that you want to do, but huh? Baby, lay off of them shoes and don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes. Yeah, you can burn my house, steal my car, my liquor from an old fruit jar. Do anything you want to do, but ha-ha, baby, lay off of them shoes and don't step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes. Really, blue, blue, blue suede shoes. 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 Do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes. Let's go one more round now. Blue, blue, blue suede shoes. 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 Do anything
for my blue suede shoes.
What about your first bands? Because was Captain Jammer, who went on to become Caius, was that your first group?
The first group I had was called Autocracy. I was like 12.
Okay. Who did they want to be?
Discharge. The band Discharge. That's how I wanted to be.
Where would you say your first kind of professional gig was then, when you first got some money for doing this?
Well, I mean, I didn't get money for...
I'm still not getting money now.
For like forever. I mean, you didn't get paid in the desert, you know? That was never a component that was introduced, so it was never part of the dialogue.
Right.
If you play a free party in the desert, asking for money is quite a dickish maneuver. And also, you know, if you drop a hat, someone will pee in it, you know? So money never was really... So first professional gig, we played with Firehose, which is Mike Watt.
Wow, that's a good band to be playing with.
Yeah, we were stoked. At a place called The Green Door in Montclair. And when we played, I think there was like 4 people. So it was good. It went well.
First hear Iggy Pop, because we're talking about people that musically have kind of had a big impact on you. He's definitely one of them.
I would say he is one of the biggest on me. I first heard the Stooges when I was about 12 years old, and I didn't like it, and I traded the record immediately. I wasn't ready for what that was. I did I was too young to get the subversive beauty of what that was. And I didn't hear Iggy Pop again until I was 20.
Big gap. Wow. Iggy was just waiting for you all that time.
Well, in Caius, it really did become this sort of... It was a beautiful set of rules, but we created this sort of Bible of can't jam with somebody else, can't do this, can't... And I think, as is the case when you're young, it's so easy to define what you don't like and what you don't want to do in order to sort of build it. We were building this artistic moat around ourselves to protect and preserve the thing that we're doing.
Keep the integrity.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have techs. We just teched our own gear.
Wow.
It was down to that SST ideal we took and ran with in a direction that probably had nothing to do with it, you know? So we moved our own gear. It wasn't for the money. It was like someone stole a bunch of money from us once, and we were like, so? You know, and we're just, you know, just... I didn't listen to other music. It was part of it. It was like...
Really? How can you not listen to it if you're in a band?
I listened to everything that I'd already listened to, and I kind of had... Like, people would say, oh, you guys sound like Sabbath. And I felt proud about being like, I've never heard them before. You know, not realizing that they had infused whatever they had done into bands like Black Flag and whatever. That I was getting the DNA of them through other sources, you know. Yeah, so when I heard Iggy, I was getting where the rules of Caius were sort of like starting to rub me the wrong way, and felt penned in by our own things. And I started listening to the Lust for Life and The Idiot kind of at the same time. And then hearing the story of their creation, and then immediately dove into the Stooges and started realizing everyone hated the Stooges and and they were dropped and no one could stand them. And it feeling that kinship of people hating Caius, you know, because for so much of Caius, it's like, wow, you guys are terrible. Or you go, well, you just don't get that, I think, then. You know? And the music and the lyrics, the attitude, that it was for girls and guys could like it too if they wanted to. Somehow, you know, it's this rock that was sexy and scary and real. And, you know, songs like The Passenger or Neighborhood Threat or Lust for Life, or you hear that song, you're like,
Here comes film. Drive a GTO, wear a uniform, a lot of government loan. I'm worth a million in prizes. Yeah, I'm through with sleeping on the sidewalk. No more beating my brains. No more beating my brains. With the liquor and drugs. With the liquor and drugs. Well, I'm just a modern guy. Of course I had it in my ear before. Could have lost for long. Could have lost for long. I got lost for long. Got lost for long. Oh, I lost for long. Oh, I lost for long.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week from Queens of the Stone Age, Joshua Homme. And that was Lust for Life by Iggy Pop, one of Josh's biggest heroes.
This is Six Music.
Six
Music.
True.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is, from Queens of the Stone Age, Joshua Homme. And that was Make It Which You from the band's 2007 album Era Vulgaris. Now, the first self-titled Queens of the Stone Age album came out in 1998 and was paid for by Josh, and he played nearly all the instruments. I asked him about that first step into the world of heading up his own outfit, playing by his own rules.
It was just me and a drummer, Alfredo Hernandez, the first drummer, which I didn't really want it to be that way, but that's the way it ended up. But I do think that ideas unfiltered are better because they're not running through these filters and being redirected, that they're just right off the tap, so to speak, you know. And that record is right from off the tap, and it's one idea. It's repetition and stiffness and trance.
You've mentioned krautrock and bands like Can as being almost an influence, which I hadn't thought about till I read it. I was like, oh yeah, they say that sort of metallic repetition, I can see where that influence comes in.
I've had the same sound man since I was 19, since Caius.
Really?
His name is Hutch, and he's been a really big influence on me, because when I refused to listen to music, he sort of would try to inject something. He's the one that injected, you know, Lust for Life and the Idiot. And he's the one, when I was first writing the first Queens record, I was like, I want to do something that is unheard, that is different. I know that's possible. And so I just trance, dance, rock, stiffness. I thought I was onto something, and he was like, have you ever heard Can? And I was like, no. And then he played me that, and I basically was like... The thing was that there was a few years of a musical gap, because when I first heard the Stooges records and Lust for Life and the Idiot, it literally helped me to want to quit music, because I was young and I was like a little disillusioned by what had gone on. And when I heard those records, I was like, well, that's what I want to say, and it's said better than I even know how to say it, so I'm gone.
I'll just give up.
Yeah, basically, for real, that was it. I sort of like, I took a 2-year break and tried to see if there were other things in life, because I never planned to be a musician. So I just was like, well, that was fun, and I'll look for... no one in my hometown is a musician for a job. It's not like it's like, well, we can be like Carl. And so I took some time away, but then it was great, because you realize, you know, I want to say this my way. I don't care if it's been said. It hasn't been said by me, and I have my way of saying it too, you know. And that was getting to that sort of robotic, trancey idea, because I hadn't heard anything like that until Hutch played me a bunch of music.
Early mythology of Queens is that you had quite a rambunctious kind of lifestyle, I guess would be one way of putting it. Can you remember the first time you got into trouble with the law?
Yeah, I can.
What happened?
Well, you know, I'm a lover, not a fighter, and I like to hug and hang out. And
of course.
Yeah, the first time I thought I was ever arrested, you mean? Or just in trouble.
Well, I was 3 years old.
Well, I've always hated the general set of rules, you know. So I've experienced a little bit of trouble my whole life, you know. And I firmly believe that you should use, you know, your moral compass, but you should try to avoid following as many rules as possible while using your moral compass. So, I mean, I've had a few run-ins with the law, but I'd rather not get into that. You know?
I wasn't thinking to glorify anything. I was just interested.
Yeah, I don't want to glorify that either. And not to mention that anyone can get in trouble at any moment. All you have to do is be foolish enough to put yourself in the wrong spot at the wrong time. You know, you get thrown out of one place and someone takes a picture, and next thing you know, branded for life.
Rated R, 2000. It's kind of the first records that sort of started to put you in people's faces, Lost Art of Keeping a Secret and those songs. How did it feel when you first started to become, like, when you started getting a bit more recognisable? Because it was clearly never about success or being recognised. But then that starts to happen.
It felt unexpected and peculiar. There's no advice that someone could give you that applies to running that gauntlet of flowers and razor blades that is starting to do well, you know.
Did you deal with it well?
Probably not. I mean, I think, you know, we were sort of wide-eyed and arms out and, like, had this attitude that was like, don't tell me, show me. And which is a fun and contagious way to be. So I think we just, instead of sauntering down the hallways of a building success, we sort of ran down the hallway, like screaming, yeah. You know, like, but I also think, you know, we were from the desert and like family guys, and so I think we were like nice guys, but loud guys, you know.
Listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on Six Music, and my guest this week from Queens of the Stone Age, Josh Homme. You heard Queens' No One Knows from 2002, featuring Dave Grohl on drums. I asked Josh when he and Dave first met.
I was 19, and it was at a place called The Off Ramp in Seattle. But we kind of knew of each other because he was in Scream, and I was friends with all the guys in Scream. It was just as he went to go try out for Nirvana that I was staying at the Wool House, which was the members of Scream, and started a new band called Wool. So Dave really hadn't even recorded yet, the one I met. And we just sort of hit it off. And, you know, even back then when Dave was telling people about Caius, he was, I don't think anyone has been a louder bullhorn for me than Dave. And I don't think anyone's sort of like done more without really thinking about it, just saying nice things and being part of each other's lives than Dave has, just in terms of screaming from the mountaintop, you know? I mean, but we've always been good friends, and we've always had something special that has nothing to do with all that. and we still have it now. It's almost my longest running collaborative friendship that I've had, yes, is mine with Dave.
On the same tack as Dave, we've got to ask you about them Crooked Vultures. The idea you have is everyone just looking at each other going, this is just, one, this is amazing, this has happened. Yeah. Two, in a minute we're going to start playing and anything could happen. This is just amazing. Was it kind of like that?
It was. It was the most sort of surreal three-way exchange of glances. And it was exciting because one of the early discussions was, this doesn't need to be a pop band. This can be a slap in the face with a glove, so to speak, musically. It can be foreign and weird and long and artistic, and it doesn't require any thoughts of like how to draw attention. It can just be perverse. We don't have to try. We just have to follow, you know, follow this kind of collective instinct. And I think for me, it was probably the most I had to say to myself, just don't think, just do. Which is great, being, you know, without brain. It made it very simple for me.
Sleepwalk by Santo and Johnny, a song that you've said is one of your favorite songs. You've mentioned this a few times.
It should definitely be played at my funeral, just in case. In case anything happens tonight.
It is a beautiful piece of music. When did you first hear it?
I don't know what age I was. I was in Idaho in the middle of the woods for the summer. That's where I was every summer. And it was on the radio, and I just thought, I don't understand what that is. I didn't know what a lap seal was at the time, or slide. And it sounded like the title. It just sounded like a dream, and it sounded perfect to me. It must have been when I was at least 11 or 12 because I was already listening to punk rock music, and it was so contrary to what I was like committed to. It hit me in a spot that almost no other music had ever hit me. You know, I love that those weird recesses in your psyche that are waiting for a song like that.
With the Arctic Monkeys, which seems to be from the outside just a real shared philosophy and a shared affection, and you talked about them with such fondness when you started working together. Where did you meet them? Where was this kind of overlap in attitudes?
I mean, I think there's a misconception that I slowed them down or weirded them out when we worked together, which really, they've been on this search, they've been playing this most dangerous game of changing every record and reaching like a rock climber for the next grip. And I just love that. And I just love them as people individually and as a group that's weathered all these storms together, you know. We first met in Houston playing a gig together in front of about 300 people, both bands.
What was that gig like?
It was fun and empty. I think we were both sort of like, yeah, sorry to each other that there's no one here, you know. But having been in Caius, where no one really liked it either, I was like, no, this means we're doing the right thing when no one's here. It was a humble beginning for us both. You know, it sort of put a cap on any potential, like, cool guy BS, you know. And then come to understand that that wasn't a possibility, because really, it's like, you couldn't be around a more down-to-earth, earnest group of people that grew up together and somehow made a bubble to protect themselves from the explosion that is their band, you know? You know, the real goal in all this is to, it's not as much about firsts, but lasts. It's, can your last record be your best record? How many people traverse this crazy, mixed-up circus of a way to live and make their best stuff towards the end? You know, people, bands peel away and artists peel away or tie a sweater around their shoulders, and that's just what happens. But who can make it through all the way and be as cool as Leonard Cohen? You know what I mean? It's like, who can navigate those waters like that? That's the real goal.
Outside the cafe by the cracker factory, you were practicing a magic trick, and my thoughts got rude as you talked and chewed on the last of your pick and mix. Said you're mistaken if you're thinking that I haven't been caught cold before, as you bit into your strawberry lace. Then I offered your attention in the form of a gobstopper. It's all you had left and it was going to waste. Your past time consisted of the strange and twisted and deranged, and I loved that little game you had called crying lightning, and how you liked to aggravate the ice cream man on rainy afternoons.
Yeah. twisted of the strange, twisted and deranged. I ate that little game you had called.
I would love to see how far my wingspan can stretch artistically, and I sort of consume music and the way I make music slowly. I want to enjoy each phase, but I see more phases and incarnations of what I do, and you know, it's really like it's staring a shape in the fog. You just see kind of the outline of what could be, and you know, you just walk towards that and hope it's not the police.
And the final thing, you get to choose the last song that we play.
Well, actually, I'd like to play a guy I've been listening to quite a bit lately that I just love. His name's J.D. McPherson. He is a blue-collar rockabilly guy, but he's a little older, so he's like maybe in his early 30s, so it's not about dressing like you're trying to be cast in the next S.E. Hinton book movie. You know what I mean? It's just music, and it's wonderful, and it's real. And his record is called Signs and Signifiers. And, well, I'll just play what has kind of been the kind of hit from there, which is Northside Gal. And if this song doesn't immediately make you happy and want to jump up and dance, then I'm really sorry about that.
It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Time for me to get off this Six Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.